In Vino Veritas, Drinking and Social Life in the Ancient World, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Historian John Darms is here to talk about drinking and society in ancient Rome. Before that, biographer John Maxwell O'Brien discusses his new book about alcohol and drinking in the life of Alexander the Great.
In the end, Alexander, like Pentheus, displayed an uncanny resemblance to his divine adversary. Thus, in the poignant finale of a life that blended triumph and tragedy, Alexander unwittingly fulfilled the role he had played with consummate skill for a lifetime, that of his own worst enemy.
Biographer John Maxwell O'Brien, he'll be back in just a moment to talk about his new book, Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Although he was a young man at the time of his death, Alexander the Great had amassed an impressive list of military and political conquests. But offsetting these achievements was a sharp personal decline, the causes of which historians continue to debate. In a new book entitled Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy, John Maxwell O'Brien examines Alexander's life by focusing on his relation to Dionysus, the ancient god not only of wine, but also of metamorphosis, of human transformation. John Maxwell O'Brien is a professor of history at Queens College and the City University of New York. He also sees in Alexander's life a pattern of ancient Greek tragedy. Because of his refusal to honor Dionysus, that is, Alexander was victimized by the god through his earthly agent, wine. I asked John Maxwell O'Brien to describe the evolution of his new book.
Well, Wayne, back in 1958, when I was an undergraduate, my professor then told the class that there was a mystery about this man, and it revolved around his personal deterioration. 7 years before he died, he began to show signs of transformation for the worse. And all of this was happening while he was simultaneously piling one conquest upon the other. How could this have come about? 20 years later, I tackled the problem and gathered all the information I could, spread it out on a table, and lo and behold, there was the common denominator, alcohol.
Now, Alexander the Great lives, how old is he when he dies? He's in his 30s?
He was 32 years of age, 1 month short of his 33rd birthday.
Now, do you look back, John, in time and call this man an alcoholic when you explain his behavior and account for his life? In terms of what you call the invisible enemy? You use a strong word like that to describe him?
Well, within the book itself, as you know already, Wayne, I do not discuss it in modern terminology. I discuss it within the context of the ancient period. Thus, Dionysus serves as a metaphor not just for wine, but also for drinking. And the subtitle, The Invisible Enemy, has to do with Alexander's peculiar relationship with the wine god.
All right, now talk to me for a couple of moments about that. I mean, here we have a palpable relationship with what we in the modern world would call a mere myth. That isn't the way it worked in the mind of Alexander.
Not at all. Dionysus was a real divinity from his frame of reference. Thus, he provides a powerful example and relationship for me to discuss Alexander and his drinking within the context of controlling assumptions of the ancient Greek world.
All right. Now, what did the ancient Greeks think about Dionysus? I mean, how did they characterize him? What kind of behavior did they associate with him? That sort of thing.
Well, he was originally a vegetation god, so he was the god of everything that breathed and everything that blossomed. He was also the god of transformation, and this could be seen most graphically in the effects of his earthly agent, wine. Through wine, Dionysus revealed his own personality and simultaneously the personality of the drinker as well.
Now, was he a dangerous god? I mean, did the Greeks look at him and say, we got to be careful as well as we adore this god, we worship him, but we also have to be careful of him?
He was an insecure god. He was the 13th god.
You're beginning to sound suspiciously modern here, almost therapeutic.
Sorry about that.
He was insecure in what way?
In this sense, became a 13th god and was forced to displace one of the canonical greater 12th gods and sat uneasy on his seat on Mount Olympus.
Let's talk specifically about the relationship between Alexander the Great and Dionysus, John O'Brien. Talk to me about that for a moment.
Well, I think something that's important to bear in mind is that Dionysus was often seen as a god for women and for more servile types rather than a god for aspiring heroes. Uh-huh. And Alexander would fit into the latter category. As a result of which, Alexander, like some other heroes, tended to neglect Dionysus. And in my biography, there's a plot. And the plot, in the end, involves divine retribution. Alexander does things which certainly must have offended the god. Alexander himself was aware of that. The retribution comes through the earthly agent wine in my book.
And what was the fatal flaw? What happened to Alexander that incurred the wrath of the god?
Well, it was encouraging his own apotheosis, seeing himself as if he were a god and acting as if he were a god, in turn challenging the latest and the youngest of the divinities on Mount Olympus.
Did Alexander call himself the Great? Where did that nickname?
No, that term came several generations after his death, and the epithet was attached to him by the Romans, uh-huh. Magnus. He's the first man in history to be called great.
Now, here's a young man who, again, dies in his early 30s, and in the last, 12 years of his life, accomplishes enormous military objectives, moves all over what we call Europe and the Far East, not the Far East, but the Middle East. Help me with the geography there. What in fact was the scope of his conquest?
Translated into modern terms and taking for granted that he came from Macedonia with some indirect control over Greece itself, he would wind up in those 11 years or so conquering modern-day Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, a portion of Israel, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and a good chunk of West Pakistan.
And he was drinking the entire time? Is that what you argue in your book?
Well, the drinking begins to become prominent at the same time as the ancients all recognized the transformation in the individual. That is, in the year 330 B.C., his drinking becomes conspicuous and sometimes self-destructive.
Now, how do you nail that down, John O'Brien? How do you figure out what motivated him and when it happened, that sort of thing? Tell me about what we're getting to here is really the ancient sources that you dealt with.
The reaction of the sources to Alexander runs a wide spectrum in the ancient world, just as it does today. Alexander is the sort of a person who evokes some type of an emotional reaction. It's rare that people feel neutral or neutrally disposed towards Alexander. By and large, people are very fond of him and admire him without reservation, or else they are extremely critical of virtually everything that he does.
Tell me about his relationship with his father. That bears on your reading of the life of Alexander the Great. There was an intense competition, a rivalry almost there.
There's an irony, Wayne, to that rivalry. Alexander spent much of his life, I think, attempting to differentiate himself from his father and to be seen as a better man between the two. Yet, in what Alexander does to establish his own reputation, you see a replication of his father's life. For instance, you'll find Philip being the first Greek-speaking general to get to the Danube. Alexander gets there and crosses it.
Indeed.
The Thebans revolt against Philip II, and he punishes them. They revolt against Alexander the Great, and he destroys the city of Thebes, which, by the way, was the birthplace of the god Dionysus, contributing to my plot. Philip flirted with the idea of becoming a god during his own lifetime. Alexander would, in fact, in some quarters, be recognized as such before he was dead.
Now, one of the reasons that you wrote this book, John O'Brien, was an attempt to answer the question, how do you account for the transformation, the metamorphosis at the end of Alexander's life? Is there a danger in organizing an entire biography around one controlling principle like that? Do you sort of to the detriment of other important elements in this man's life?
Indeed, there is, as I emphasize in my preface, that the approach must of necessity be disproportionate. Mm-hmm. But it's hoped that the yield that comes from this oblique stratagem, a stratagem that Alexander himself would be familiar with because he approached the enemy on the battlefield in an oblique way, he would fully understand that this often gives you quite an impressive harvest.
John O'Brien, how does your book about Alexander the Great fit into the arc of biographies about this man? He was looked upon as a hero. He was looked upon as an anti-hero. Where do you fit into this?
Well, as you will see in my epilogue, and readers will see as well, I view Alexander as being a tragic hero, a real, live, breathing tragic hero, a man who in every sense of the word reflects Aristotle's criteria concerning what a tragic hero should be.
Tell me what you mean by the word tragedy. What, for instance, might the relationship, in your view, be between Alexander the Great and tragedy, Greek drama, all of that?
My prologue talks about Pentheus in the Bacchae, Euripides' Bacchae. And in fact, it's part of the orchestration of my book, which is in fact a Greek tragedy. It's a biography, but it follows all of the criteria suggested by Aristotle for tragedy.
It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a plot, and it has characters.
It has a prologue of enhanced language, and it all consummates in an epilogue, which in fact mirrors the prologue. So I followed Aristotle throughout the book without advertising it. This biography is a tragedy.
Well, John O'Brien, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Let me tell our listeners about you. You're a professor of history at Queens College of the City University of New York. Your new book is Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy. It's a biography. It's published in the United States by Routledge. Did you have fun writing this book, John?
It was a torment and a pleasure simultaneously, a Dionysiac experience.
Like the life of Alexander himself.
Indeed.
John Maxwell O'Brien, thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. I wish you well in your work.
And you as well.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Drinking and the Social Lives of the Ancient Romans. Join me now for a conversation with historian John Darms of the University of Michigan.
The word for drunkenness is ebrietas. Somebody who is in a fairly perpetual state of drunkenness, the word is vinolentia. The adjective for being regularly in a state of drunkenness, not just drunk once, is ebriosus. The dinner, which could be anything from a small party to really quite a grand affair, is a convivium.
Historian John Darms, he says that among the points of interest that scholars of antiquity have lately begun to explore are eating and drinking in the world of the ancient Romans. He also notes that an analysis of these practices can enrich our modern understanding of ancient Roman thinking and behavior. John Darms is a professor of classics at the University of Michigan, where he also serves as dean of the graduate school. He says that the evidence regarding how and what the ancient Romans ate and drank is intriguing. Coming as it does from a variety of sources, that evidence includes the writing of moralists and philosophers, Roman dramatists and satirists, archaeological remnants, and historical accounts of political events in which dining and drinking were prominent. I asked John Darms to reflect on the ways that he approaches the venerable and volatile notion of truth in wine, in vino veritas.
Well, I think of two things. I think first of the power of wine to inspire the poets, to bring out the truth, to make people more agreeable, and to say things which that might otherwise be locked in secret.
Not to mention how they reveal themselves to ancient historians.
Right. But secondly, I think that this truth, as it's described in Roman settings, is often very conditioned by the fact that truth can sometimes, when provided or promoted by drink, lead to anger, lead to angry outbursts, and that needed to be controlled, and Romans were worried about that.
Well, now, and that sounds very modern. That's the way we talk about it. It's okay to go out to a dinner party and have a couple of drinks, and you have a designated driver, but you'd never turn up that way in the workplace. I take it the Romans thought the same way?
Much the same. There are some wonderful accounts of a distinguished Roman consul coming out of a cook shop with wine on his breath early in the morning, and this really rose the hackles of some critics.
Let's talk about some specific individuals. Mark Antony, a name that many people would know from Shakespeare's play. You know him in another context when we talk of eating and drinking in the Roman world.
Well, he's an interesting figure because he has a very heavy, large reputation in antiquity as a very heavy drinker. This comes largely from Cicero, who was his sworn enemy, and so one doesn't know how much to make of it. But the main point here is that when Antony's drinking at a wedding, that's one thing. When Antony is trying to conduct the public business, that and shows up drunk, that's what causes real offense to in a Roman setting.
Well, you say in this paper that you've given me to read that we have to be very careful about transferring our modern mindsets backward in time and saying, yes, there was alcoholism back there. Now, you also reverse yourself. You say, yes, indeed, there was such a thing as alcoholism, but not the way we talk about it.
Well, I think one needs to try to think oneself into the Roman mind in this matter. The Romans certainly could make a distinction between a person who happened to be drunk and who was also, and who on the other hand was in a kind of chronic condition of drunkenness. But there was really no attention in the Roman world to drunkenness as a physical condition. It was much more a matter of character flaw. And that's why one can't use modern terminology, medical terminology.
Like disease, like a word like disease. So
now, this doesn't mean that one can't look at some Roman cases to see if anybody was what we would call diseased. And it's they're difficult.
What about children? You also write about children and the use of wine in the ancient Roman world with kids. That may strike modern audiences as utterly perverse. Tell me about it.
Well, my question really is, I think any historian's question is, when do young people learn this behavior of drinking? Some drinking or excess drinking? And it's clear that young children had wine prescribed as
Medicinally, sure.
For some diseases, and there might be other settings, maybe marked cultural occasions, such as a wedding or a feast.
But there was no onus attached to this. I mean, it wasn't the sort of thing that would instantly call down the indignation of the community.
Well, I can't think of cases where a young person is chastised for drunkenness. A very young person, a child. My own take on this is that it's during adolescence, as in so many other societies, where you are in the company of your elders that you're introduced to wine, but then you go off into your own bands of young men and other forms of social association in which you do your heavy drinking.
Do you associate John Darm's drinking and drunkenness solely with the upper classes, the aristocracy in the ancient world?
Well, there are plenty of signs that slaves and the members of the lower classes who live in big apartment blocks were drunk on more than one occasion, maybe routinely drunk. And all kinds of reasons why in the streets of Rome the poor would get their hands on excessive drink when they could to alleviate all kinds of pain. So we do see the penetration of heavy drinking into other parts of society.
Now, I don't want to make too much of a stretch across the ages here or trivialize your subject, but here we are just having inaugurated a new president, and the papers are full of stories about how we have a mood change. We have, now they're eating barbecue, Arkansas barbecue in Washington, rather than Texas barbecue, for instance. The role of the emperor, that's what I'm getting to. Here you had, in the figure of a single person, a kind of a catalyst for the way the ancient Romans thought about drinking and what they would take in. Is this right?
Absolutely. They thought the emperor really provides a reference point for discourse of all moral kind. And so when an emperor gives a dinner party and an emperor does some drinking, people watch closely as to how much or how little.
And we're talking major league dinner parties here.
And a particular emperor's, like Hadrian, liked to prolong the evening and do a lot of drinking. Another one, like Trajan, was rather moderate and wanted to get out a little earlier.
Uh-huh.
This is always represented by the Roman upper classes as the perfect convivial form, whichever it happened to be. People could adjust.
It was taken as a sort of a model.
Yeah.
Is it possible, John Darms, to look back again over the ages and draw from the behavior of the ancient Romans insights into our own ways of behaving or thinking? Do they live in a world which is utterly of their own making and life?
Well, it's a strange world. It's highly civilized and accessible on the one hand as we read their literature. Yet there are marked degrees of hierarchy, marked degrees of status inequalities, and high degree also of theatricality, and a kind of brutality that seems to us almost incomprehensible.
Yeah, I've heard it said that they're very cruel people, actually.
Well, at a rather grand convivial party, it's said in one of our sources, a dog brought in a human hand from the street.
Oh my goodness!
And dropped it in front of the emperor, and no one paused for a second. This was regarded as a kind of routine occurrence, and it's that sort of thing that sends a sort of chill through those of us who have different sensibilities.
Is it true, to come to a very specific point, John Darms, that the Romans poisoned themselves with the lead that was contained in the jars, the canisters, the glasses that they drank out of? I remember reading stories about things like
that. There's still a lot of controversy about the degree to which lead poisoning did lead to the downfall of Rome. What needs to be analyzed is the toxic quality of surviving lead vessels, but the real question is how much was really preserved in lead vessels? Not so very much. These amphorae in which wine was stored were terracotta, were clay, and cups were often of glass or other things. So lead in quantity may not have had quite the power to poison that some scholars have maintained.
John, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. You say that the function of drink in the ancient world may have had a very convivial dimension to it, but it also has a what you call a darker backdrop. Does one necessarily take precedence over the other? I mean, do you come down for or again, so to speak?
I think there's more to be thought about this. It strikes me that much of the talk about drinking and the pleasures of drinking has a grimmer backdrop. A small amount of drink will make a fearful soldier stronger and more courageous. Drink will assuage anxieties and cares. The old and the infirm get a little bit of temporary relief.
A trace of comfort here and there.
On the other hand, there is no doubt that there was a strong belief in some sectors of society in the power of drink to unlock truth, to come back to where we started. the very strong ability of drink to give access to what was no longer illusory and deceiving, but actually so.
So the Romans took this this notion of in vino veritas, they took that quite literally.
Even though the phrase is Greek and moved into a Roman setting by others, the question of truth and wine, so connected with the gods, and so and the gods were so connected to Greek and Roman thought, we really have to think hard about.
Well, John Darmes, I want to thank you for contributing to Soundings. You are the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs and the Dean of the Graduate School at the University of Michigan, where you are a professor of classics and history. I'm also happy to say that you're a trustee of the National Humanities Center. John Darmes, thanks for coming by to talk on Soundings.
I've enjoyed talking with you, Wayne. I think it's time for us to go and get a cup of tea.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were John Maxwell O'Brien and John Darmes. John Maxwell O'Brien teaches at Queens College and the City University of New York. His new book is Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy, available from Routledge. John Darmes is Dean of the Graduate School at the University of Michigan. He's at work on a study of dining and drinking in the ancient Roman world. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 664. That's number 664, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week, Lives in Between. Leo Spitzer, an historian at Dartmouth College, will be here to discuss his book about social assimilation and social marginality in the lives of three families from Austria, Brazil, and West Africa. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. In Vino Veritas, Social Life and Drinking in the Ancient World, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations featuring scholars from Queens College and the University of Michigan. John Maxwell O'Brien will be here to talk about his new book, Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy, an account of drinking and alcohol in Alexander's life. John Darmes of the University of Michigan will also be on hand to talk about drinking and alcohol in the world of the ancient Romans. In Vino Veritas, Social Life and Drinking in Antiquity, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.